VDL mobile.
September of 1982 is when the TechNet was sort of created. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, because Dick at least is so darn forgetful. You have to give him his name again, even though you've signed in lots of times. And the confirming yes. And the word yes, when you say it, means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A sign-in might sound like this. KB2, DPD, Gerald.
Repeater, timeout.
Or KB2, DOT, Joe. Those are some of the possible things that you might hear. So, do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name, and that confirming yes. K2RIW listening.
K2RIY, Joe, yes.
Joe recognized. Anyone else?
This is WS2N, Paul, with a yes with a space report, Dick.
Okay. When you said yes, I know you got a space report. Do you also have a possible question, Paul?
No, I just put in yes for a comment. Just on the space report, Dick, for this evening. Although I'll think of something later. Back to you, Dick.
In fact, I did say question or comment. Space report is a hell of a lot more than a comment. Very appropriate for a yes. I should have recognized that. Okay, we got Joe and Paul so far. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letters, name, and the confirming yes.
KC2, QIQ, Glenn, and no, not pronounced Dick.
Oh, we're going to hear from you tonight, Glenn, because I'm quite sure we're going to be talking about light-emitting diodes and these switching regulators, constant current, constant voltage, whatever, that power them. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name.
Yes. WA2CDL, listening, and maybe throwing a comment or two regarding LED light bulbs, since I brought up the subject. Thank you.
Hey, you re-brought up the subject, Andy. It was a brand new subject for you, but it turns out that Glenn, the week before, gave us quite a report, and Eric, KE2EJ, gave us quite a report. So, it was a new subject to you. But okay, be glad to hear from you, Andy. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now.
Intuio checking in, Dick, no question.
No for now, but I know Rich is going to have a question later on. Anyone else?
KC2MDP, Steve, no questions.
Okay, Steve with a no. Anyone else?
Steve, all K2KEY.
I wonder who that guy was. Okay. That masked rider, that mystery man was Mel. the co-interlocutor of this particular technical net. Alrighty, we got more than enough to get started. Joe is the first person with a real question. After we handle those questions, we're going to open up the floor to light-emitting diodes, digital television, anything you guys want to talk about. The subjects that are talked about on the TechNet, for the most part, are not planned. It's the subject matter and questions you guys bring to the net. What's on your mind? And whatever on the mind of a ham radio operator is appropriate. It can be electronics, it can be blondes, it can be anything. Let's see which one of those subjects Joe's got on his mind. The B2RYY, who I think is on an RF link tonight, K2RYW. You got it, Joe.
Now I'm coming in via the internet.
Okay, we hear a little bit of echo and delay in the background, but go right ahead with your question, Joe. You're number one on the runway.
Okay, thank you, Dick. I was able to hook up my DTV antenna and preamp and get everything installed on the house, non-rotatable, but at least it works, and I pick up several stations out of New York City. A lot more than I was surprised I'd actually pick up. Still can't get channel 61 DT. My question is concerning some of these channels. I made measurements on these channels, and some of them I could pick up okay, but they seem to have actually a minimum amount of signal across them if I look at them on a spectrum algorithm. I just wonder if that's just because of simple reflections that I'm getting or what it is. Because one channel, I get it down to channel 61, which the pilot carrier comes in at minus 67, but I get a dip. Let's see, the pilot carrier is 752.3094. If I look at 753.8, the signal goes down to minus 105. It goes back up to about minus 70, 75, and then it dips again at 756.330. That channel, I cannot copy a TV channel at all. Well, that's just simply not decoded. Another channel I'm getting the same effect on, which I can copy the digital channel, is channel 56. I get a minus 60 at 722.3094, but it goes down to minus 100 at 722.660, and 725.160. And it rises to about minus 70, 75 in between those frequencies gradually. It almost looks like you're looking at the tracking curve of a, like say, like a notch type of duplex, if you ever remember seeing what that would look like. You look at something, it looks very similar when you look at that with a spectrum analyzer. I'm just wondering if this is just simple multipath I'm getting or something else is happening. Because the other channels I look at, like digital channel 53, the pilot carrier is minus 56, but I get a nice even minus 70 across the entire 6 megs of the channel of like the digital type of noise that it displays. Any comments, Dick?
Yes, I do. First of all, the fact that you're having trouble receiving channel 61 is reasonably well known. Whenever Eric discussed that one to us, for the time being, that particular channel, I think, is running very low power, something like 1,000 watts, where some of the other channels are running a hell of a lot more power than that. It also was using a less than desirable antenna at this time. That will change. That's in the process of change. But the antenna has a kind of a built-in multipath within the antenna, and it's fill antenna that's at the Empire State Building. So the fact that you have trouble getting 61 is understandable. The fact that some of those channels have a apparent notch within the 6 megacycles of the channel when viewed with a spectrum analyzer and you're measuring power flux density, units of dBm per kilohertz or dBm per 10 kilohertz or however you're setting your resolution bandwidth, the fact that you see a notch of power, according to what Eric is telling us and according to the reports that I'm reading, no real digital television channel is really transmitting any kind of a notch. In other words, if you can see the signal directly with line of sight path and no multipath, the signal will always look like what's called a bunt head haircut. In other words, it will be a noisy looking signal completely flat across the band with a very steep fall off of skirts at the lower edge and the upper edge. And if you're using a narrow enough resolution bandwidth of the spectrum analyzer, you will see 300 and some odd kilohertz in from the low end, the so-called pilot tone. But the pilot tone is only resolvable with a narrow bandwidth filter. Let me drop for a second. But the way the 8VSB signal, the digital signal, is transmitted to a spectrum analyzer, it looks like a completely noisy, constant amplitude signal across the channel. That's the way it's transmitted. Because of errors in the antenna system itself, temporary errors in the antenna, and or because of multipath, you can get what's called selective fading. Many of us in the old days have listened to foreign broadcast stations that are amplitude modulated, and periodically it gives you a Donald Duck sound. What's really happening is you're getting a direct signal, an indirect signal, and at certain frequencies across the bandwidth of the transmitted signal, the direct signal and the indirect signal fall out of phase and are nearly equal in amplitude, so you get a notch. And when the notch notches out the carrier, you're listening to a single sideband or a double sideband. You're listening to double sideband suppressed carrier without the carrier coming through. It sounds like Donald Duck. Real amplitude modulation requires you to beat the carrier against the upper and lower sideband within the detector circuit of your receiver in order to recover the audio envelope properly. Without that carrier, the double sideband suppressed carrier has twice the frequency for each individual tone going through, plus some distortion. So it sounds like Donald Duck. So selective fading, we've all heard that on amplitude-modulated shortwave listener stations in VHF frequencies where a television reception has taken place. When multipath occurs, selective fading also can happen. And from time to time, you may see the selective fade move across the channel. As the weather conditions change and the individual path lengths of your multipath change. So what you're seeing, I am believing, is either multipath within the transmitting antenna or multipath of the environment, because the real transmitting signal coming out of the transmitter is not doing that. Depending on the degree of the suckout, depending on the amplitudes of all the signals and the time delays, the equalizer network built into the front end of your digital converter, which is either part of your television set or the separate box you got on the outside, either can or cannot reconstruct that signal. There's a whole lot of forward error correcting built into the protocol of the digital signal.
Repeater, timeout.
As I was starting to say, there's a whole lot of error correcting built into the protocol of the packet-like transmissions, individual packets of information, of the actual digital signal. So a certain amount of error correcting can take place. Therefore, some of those suckouts, you'll continue to get a picture, and some of them you will not. So now that you're taking a more careful look at the spectrum, for a whole bunch of reasons, because you're doing a scientific study there, Joe, you're seeing what selective fading of multipath really looks like. That's my guess. I hope Eric is present, KE2EJ, who I guarantee has looked at this a lot more than I have, maybe even more than you have, can add some extra words to it. So if Eric is present, I'm going to turn it over to him for any further words on the subject. KE2EJ, our local broadcast engineer, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh boy, I heard my name, but I didn't hear the question. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Okay, I told them you walk on water. I told them that you can heal the sick. I told them you were going to tell us how you do that and how you get rich quick at the same time. That's what I told them, Eric. Okay, in seriousness, Joe has been running around with his spectrum analyzer version of his, what would you call it now? His piece of test set, the test equipment that you use, his service monitor. His service monitor-like test equipment has a spectrum analyzer function, either from the home QTH or from various locations. He has looked at the spectrum of digital channels, and he sees suckouts. Occasionally, he can still continue to get television, digital television reception with the suckout present within the 6-meg channel. Quite frequently, he cannot. Also, he is being amazingly unsuccessful in getting channel 61. I told him it's not the fault of his equipment, that temporarily there's some errors in the antenna that's doing the transmitting. Channel 61 is also a high frequency, most subject to some of these errors, and channel 61 is also a relatively weak signal, so not to be alarmed by the fact he's having trouble getting 61. But the suckouts that he's seeing, I am guessing, are a selective fading of a multipath function, somewhat like the Donald Duck sound we periodically hear when a shortwave signal is being received, and the selective fading of multipath creates a notch of the carrier, and therefore the double sideband suppressed carrier sounds like Donald Duck. So that's what I'm guessing is the nature of the suckouts that he has seen, on the assumption that his antenna itself doesn't have any suckouts. Those are my guesses, Eric. KE2EJ, I bet you've seen things like that. K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, what are you calling a suckout? Does it go down to the noise floor, or is it just a dent in the flatness of the signal that he's looking at?
He's looking at 25 dB dents in the middle of the 6-meg channel. Eric, go ahead.
All right, well, I'm going to show you a nice one. Because the symbol timing, the noise, that's actually something that you can do, you can create by rotating the antenna. I don't know what the physics behind it is, but there is this selective reflection that seems to, addition and subtraction, that seems to go on with an antenna depending upon which, you know, you're looking at, say, a horizontally polarized signal. As you rotate the antenna left and right, you'll see a certain amount of that kind of stuff going on. I don't have an explanation for it at this point, although it's just an interesting subject that a number of people have been talking about, and there's a whole bunch of theories out there. But given if he's able to pick up a picture with a big hole in it, but not down to the noise floor, there's an up signal left, and he's using a modern-day converter, let's say, which has a fifth or seventh generation equalizer in it, chances are he's still going to get a picture. You may find it blocking out occasionally, or maybe the audio pops a little bit, because when the disturbances are that deep, if you're saying 25 dB, chances are that it's working real hard to make up for the difference. And as far as channel 61 goes, it depends upon where you are. If you happen to be north and west of the Empire State Building, you shouldn't have any problem. It is weak. It's only about, we start off with 1,000 watts, and when it makes it upstairs to the 86th floor and comes out of the combiner, you're lucky if you're left with about 700 watts, and then you've got to go another 300 feet into the antenna. So there's not a heck of a lot of energy there, but Then again, if you can see it, you don't need much. I mean, I get it here at home. I don't get it out in Plainview at the station. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, let's hear about that. At Plainview, you've got a significant tower, good location, and you're 30 miles out, and you're unable in that ideal line of sight to the Empire State Building, unable to get 61. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, let me qualify it. With the third generation equalizer, I can't get it. But I get it perfectly well when they turn off the backfill antenna. And the problem with Empire at the moment is that they flew around it with a helicopter and said, gee, we're missing RF in this southern, southeastern direction. And the reason for that was there were four panels put up around the mooring mast. We had some space in it, and it wasn't quite right, and the back reflector was broken, and it was making itself, was actually reflecting against itself and causing cancellation. So the guys at CBS looked at it from an RF standpoint and said, we need to fix this. So what they decided to do was to put another antenna in, take down that bad panel on the, between the 81st floor, 82nd floor, and the 86th floor, they mounted another antenna. If you look carefully at the Empire State Building, and on the left and right sides, you'll see some antennas that never used to be there that are pretty big. You can see them. And they decided we'll put that in, hook that into the combiner, use a waveguide splitter, light that sucker up, fly around it with a helicopter again, and voila, they've accomplished the test. There's RF in every direction. Except that one symbol time is 92 nanoseconds. I don't want to go through it again, but what they're doing is they're creating their own multipath, so it makes it very difficult to pick it up. When they turn that backscatter antenna off, 30 miles away, line of sight, third generation equalizer, I have no problem picking it up. It's really nice. So there's the story. K2RW, KE2J.
I think you indicated that you are filing a report with the technical details of that backfill antenna on, backfill antenna off, what reception you got in Plainview with a third generation demodulator. I think you said you did file that report. Let's hope it has been well received and understood. What do you think, Eric?
Oh, it was received well. It was thanked. It was actually sent to all the engineering staff that created the antenna, but their excuse was, well, when the digital transition occurs, which was supposed to happen 11 days from now, which has now been extended to June, they would then do the next phase of their thing. Because they're going off low VHF, there's a couple of slots up at the top. They were going to replace those antennas, put a new set of 4-bay UHFs in there with the proper power splitter, and voila, problem solved. So they're really not going to do anything about it until the transition occurs and they can put the antennas up at the top, which will actually going to take them a couple of days to do. And that's their solution. So there's your answer.
Concerning the transition, as you probably know, Congress finally completed the decision this week that February 17th, the tradeover date in which all of digital television was supposed to be the main regulation, and all of analog television was supposed to cease to exist. Well, that decision, because the Commerce Department ran out of money, ran out of the ability to send out these $40 coupons, and lots of people with limited budgets and limited cash flow are not going to be able to have digital television. The set's going to go dark, and there's no solution for them. Congress suddenly developed empathy for those people and said, okay, we're going to put it off until June. Hopefully somebody will, in this cash bailout situation that's going on, find some money for the Commerce Department. More coupons will be issued, and everyone will get a chance. However, as I'm hearing from a PBS News report, among other things, that a few of the analog television stations are going to go off analog television and flip over to digital television somewhere between February 17th and June 12th for economic reasons. They have no choice. They don't have the ability to maintain two completely independent transmitting sites, a digital one and an analog one. So some of them are going to transfer over early. the good news is not all of them are doing it, so that in most metro areas, people with analog television will still have something to watch, maybe not all their channels. And exactly which channels are flipping over is not yet clear. We were told to listen to our individual channels and find out what they've decided to do. However, I wonder if you happen to have any inside information on that, Eric, as to which ones you know are going to switch over earlier than, let's say, June 12th, question number one. And question number two, when the digital switchover does take place, would I be correct in guessing that channel 61 might cease to exist and that becomes digital channel 13 frequency-wise? KE2EJ for any of that info. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2J. Well, New York City, nobody has to worry until June 12th. There's nobody here. It's been decided that nobody's going to switch over early here. And actually, if a station does switch over early, they probably will do it on the 17th. And, of course, they have to, start brokering the fact that they're going to make that change. Look, it costs us $15,000 a month to run the analog transmitter, just in electricity. So for some stations, it's a big issue. It's like if it weren't the economic times it was, and Mr. Madoff didn't run off with a lot of money, chances are a lot of people would have actually continued to use the analog until the changeover date. But it's more complicated than that, because some stations are making the change and moving to frequencies where they're currently occupied. One of the things is that the distance between stations has an effect. In the analog world, as you know, we don't run adjacent channels. We keep what we call a white space in between them. There's lots of reasons for that. We can go into that some other time. With digital, you can put one channel right next to each other. So with the shuffling of channels in some places, it's not possible to do that without creating interference for one or the other. And as far as 61 goes, it goes back to 13, and we've tested out the 13, and it does an amazing job. People can pick it up further away than we could even imagine that they would. The interesting aspect of the high VHF is it seems to work one heck of a lot better than the UHF does. K2RIW, KE2J.
Wow, let's have a couple of words on that. Are you saying that the current range of analog signal on frequency channel 13 becomes equal to or possibly greater than, in some cases, the range of channel 13 frequency-wise digital? Does digital have the possibility of greater range even before the increase in power, the enhancement, I think it's called, which will take place later on in the year? A couple more words on that one, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if we exceed our grade B, but we have some, I had some people made aware that there was going to be some tests going on, and I did get reports from people who were well inside the grade B zone that just couldn't get anything on 61, but as soon as 7 and 13 lit up on their VHF, boy oh boy, everybody that I talk to that has the receiver, that has an antenna, they all got them. So, I mean, I'm talking about some people that are, 60 miles away from Empire, and they didn't have a problem.
Okay. Very good. Now,
K2YY, question on channel 13.
Go ahead with your question, Joe. And as soon as you finish your question, I got some further information about what Eric was saying with reference to rotating an antenna and seeing some funny effects. You got it, Joe.
Okay, I didn't have the current TV antenna up the last time Channel 13 ran a digital test. I had a monitor antenna up with a preamp on it, and I was able to get a very good carrier signal on the analog, and I waited at like 3 o'clock when the thing went off. I could not get and decode any DTV signal at all. The signal was just at the threshold for where it looked like it wanted to lock as far as the level indicator on the receiver, and I was using one of the Zenith DT901, so it just didn't want to copy the signal where I was getting a good picture on the analog carrier. DT-wise, it was about maybe 10 or 15 dB as far as I noticed the carrier level compared to channel 13's output. There was some drop in the level, but I couldn't get a signal. Were you actually transmitting a TV picture at that time, or was that just some other test to put a carrier on the air without any picture information?
So, let me just ask this question. When you were looking to pick up channel 13, did you make the box stupid and start from zero? Because that's one of the problems, is that the receivers have to research, find a new set of precepts, understand that there's new frequency information. And it's like my receiver here, when they first went on, it's like, what's wrong? Oh, I didn't scan. And as soon as I made it forget everything and start all over, there it was. But that's the typical issue that happens with digital boxes, by the way.
When I tried to scan, it would not lock up on that channel. Manually, it was at the threshold of seeing the channel. I could get an indication that it was there. You'd actually see the signal level meter go about maybe from a quarter scale to half scale, but it never would lock up on a picture at all. I looked at the level of the picture with my spectrum analyzer coming off the same antenna lead going into the converter, and it was about 10, maybe 15 dB lower than the picture carrier level coming from what channel 13, because I looked at that previously before it went off the air. But I could never lock up on a DT signal on channel 13.
Where are you located?
Sayville. And when is the next time channel 13 is going to be running a digital test in place of the analog transmissions?
Oh, that's interesting, because I had some people who were picking it up at Port Jeff and some people who were picking it up in Smithtown and a few other places out that way. So, don't forget that the analog signal, the peak of the picture carrier, that is 24 kilowatts going into 6 dB, 7 dB of gain antenna. And when the digital went on, it was 2.4 kilowatts going into the same antenna.
Okay, Smithtown is higher in elevation than I am, and so is Port Jeff. As you go toward the North Shore, the elevation rises a little bit, so I'm only about maybe 25 to 30 feet above sea level where I happen to be. But I still was amazed that I couldn't get a picture at all on the digital picture, even though the level was high enough where the decoder should have decoded the picture.
What were you using for an antenna, Joe? Was it a rooftop real Yagi? Or was it something in the house? I know you did say earlier you were not using a rotator yet. Over to you, Joe.
At that particular time, I did not have the TV antenna set up. I was using a vertically polarized disc cone antenna, which gave me, you know, enough of an amplification, a signal through, especially being amplified, because I could see channel 2 from New York on UHF. So if I could see that, I certainly should be able to see channel 13, frequency 210 to 216. But it just wouldn't decode on it. Now I've got the right antenna up, I've got the Weingart antenna up, the Weingart preamp, horizontally polarized, and I get signal level right now. Channel 7 is about minus 30 dBm on the picture carrier, and it's about maybe a little about minus 40, 42 for the picture carrier for channel 13.
Would I be correct in assuming that your Weingart horizontally polarized real television aerial is in general getting 15 or 20 decibels stronger on most of the channels compared to the vertically polarized disc cone? Over to you, Joe.
Of course, because if I let the digital converter scan, it gives me a total of 29 viewable channels that I can now pick up.
Whereas with the disc cone, you had how many viewable digital channels?
Sometimes 6, sometimes 8.
Okay, so 6 or 8 channels became 29 channels when you went to an antenna with the right polarization. You already know that when you're using a cross-polarized antenna, you get some very peculiar effects. And if you want to get technical, the effects are called atmospheric chirality. In other words, depending on the nature of the multipath reflecting objects in your particular neighborhood, a vertical signal can become horizontal and vice versa. When I listen to this particular repeater, 146.85, in my particular bathroom in Huntington, I have to set the handy-talkie on the wooden shelf. I have to set it horizontal. For some crazy reason, when the signal gets into my backyard, it becomes horizontal, even though it started out at the at Glen Oaks as a pure vertical signal. So you do get some peculiar effects, which can really add to the suckouts. Now, this adds to what Eric is discussing earlier. If you take an antenna where you have some anticipation of its pattern, a main lobe, some side lobes, some back lobes, a good antenna design, the first side lobe should be 13 or more dB down, maybe 17. The secondary and tertiary side lobe should be weaker than that. The front-to-back ratio should be a healthy 15 dB on a good antenna. And if there was only one single path from the antenna source, from the source of signal, to the antenna being measured, and you've got the antenna being measured connected to the right kind of equipment and a strip chart, or the equivalent of a strip chart recorder, and you rotate the antenna, you will see as a polar or rectangular plot, a Cartesian plot, you will see the plot of the antenna pattern. That's the good news. Let me drop. If there's more than one path, particularly if you got off to one side, or a building, a water tower, a house, a bank of trees, whatever, as you rotate the main lobe into that extraneous object, and the main lobe is now getting the reflected signal simultaneous to the side lobes getting the direct signal, you can get some very peculiar effects. Selective fades, suckouts, you get some very peculiar effects. This is a known phenomenon. It's the main reason whenever you're setting up an antenna range and you're trying to measure the pattern of an antenna, it is a much more severe test than just simply measuring by substitution or the Fries method, F-R-I-I-S, the technical technique for measuring absolute gain of an antenna. If you're measuring the absolute gain of the bore site by comparing it to a standard, you have a certain requirement for the integrity of the antenna range. If you want to measure the pattern of the antenna by rotating it, it takes a much more severe set of requirements for that antenna range as far as extraneous reflectivity of objects, both down on the ground and off at various azimuth angles. So almost none of us have a backyard or an environment where the antenna on the roof is going to have anywhere near that kind of local range integrity where you could really measure the pattern of the antenna. I got around that problem when I really wanted to measure the very carefully measure the pattern of a 19-element Yagi that I had just invented. I put that in quotes, in 1977, 1978. I had various guys on the 432 band send me a steady-state carrier for 2 solid minutes while they rotated the antenna. And I did that with a guy to the west, a guy to the northwest, a guy to the north, a guy to the southwest, a guy to the east. And by studying those patterns, I eventually found out, yes, the Dix Hills water tower is in that particular direction. Whenever the antenna was aimed there, I got weird effects. But by using various guys sending me a signal from various azimuth directions, I could eventually find out what was the true pattern of my antenna when it was rotated. And it took a whole lot of Kentucky windage to select the true from the, to select the wheat from the chaff, if you know what I mean. So, antenna pattern measurement in a real world environment will give you some really peculiar effects. It is my belief.
Repeater, timeout.
It's my belief that that's what you were seeing, Eric. KE2EJ for any further comments on that one. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, 13 is very horizontally polarized. Flash polarization, gives you that 20 dB loss in terms of signal strength. Also, I don't know how to figure. I mean, I understand a dish cone, and I don't know how I would deal with that, because I actually have never really paid attention to anything vertically polarized, so I'm not going to say. But if you have the proper horizontal polarization of an antenna, yeah, the north side of the island is a little higher than the south. You also have the big hill, the drop in elevation between Nassau and Suffolk County, so that plays a role in it. But if you've got your antenna at the point where you can physically see the Empire State Building, you shouldn't have a problem at all. As far as the suckouts go, I'm not going to go there until I understand more about how that's occurring. Some of it is multipath, but when you're talking about 25 dB worth of dent in it, there's something more than multipath is going on. And actually, in the reality of multipath that will stop a receiver from working, there's the kind of multipath where you don't see anything on a spectrum area. It still looks nice and flat, but you look at the equalizer, it's going nuts. K2RW, K2EJ.
Due to multipath, when I was rotating that Yagi of mine, I saw suckouts at least 15 to 20 dB down. I didn't say that they happen a lot. They're rare. But when you get two signals that just happen, happen to be equal in amplitude, as you rotate, the echo I get in the main lobe and the direct signal I get into a side lobe can easily be exactly equal in amplitude, and because the path length can be 180 degrees out of phase. So you can get a suck out, a frequency selective fade suck out that can easily give you 15, 20, 25 dB. I've seen it often. I didn't say it happens all the time, but it happens. So that doesn't amaze me. A disc cone antenna is almost purely vertical. And although the horizontal transmission from the Empire State Building, you would think he would have a 20 dB null, in his particular environment, some of the reflecting objects are going to twist the polarization. A lot of people have trouble with that one. The best way I can explain it is make believe I've got a hand mirror in my hand, and I lay the hand mirror on the table in front of me, and you're on the other side of the table. I look at you directly, I see you in a normal manner. I look at you in the mirror on the table, and I see you inverted. No surprise there. I hold the mirror in my hand off to my right-hand side, and I hold the mirror at the exact same altitude as my eyes, and I look at you direct, and I look at you in the mirror, and I see you reversed left to right. No surprise there. However, if I hold this hand mirror halfway between the table and the right-hand side, I hold it off to the right, down below, and I orient it so I see you, I will see your picture as a horizontal human being. Directly I see you as a vertical human being. In the mirror held in that position, I will see you as a horizontal picture. That's an example of how a particular complex reflection can give you polarization rotation. It's a kind of three-dimensional angle of incidence, angle of reflection type thing. The environment of real reflecting objects, water towers, buildings, and whatever, can give you a certain percentage of vertical polarization, even though the transmission was originally purely horizontal. As I said, a lot of people have trouble with that one. And when you start adding circular polarization, crazy effects, anomalies, life really gets complicated.
Repeater, timeout.
And the number of antenna engineers that feel confident in that situation becomes small real fast. Okay, Joe, looks like you're doing some darn interesting experiments. I presume your new WineGuide antenna is mounted on the chimney. It doesn't have a rotator yet, but there are some inexpensive rotators out there. Once you add the rotator and you can aim to the southwest and to the north where you pick up Connecticut stations, even though you're on the South Shore, I think your number of 29 digital channels will improve. However, you're going to have the problem of, to force your particular digital converter to scan, you have to erase its memory in some cases in order to find the stations when you're aimed up north. Maybe there's a way of storing one memory, if there was such a thing, for the western stations when your antenna's aimed toward the Empire, or the northern stations when you're aimed up toward Connecticut. W-A-2-R-Y-Y for any further comments. K-2-R-A-W on the TechNet.
I have a rotator for the installation I have up on the roof, but I cannot put the rotator on because I dare not put anything else on the tripod. The tripod's got to be replaced. I just put this up on a temporary basis just to be able to get a picture up there. My other question related to this, it's not related to DTB, but it's related to it's an antenna question, is I've been looking for a UHF Yagi, multi-element beam, something like in the order of about 10 or 12 elements, something that'll give me fairly sharp pattern. And I'd like to find one that has a UHF female connector on it. What I've come up with is there are some manufacturers that make that. They make them, I think, what they call black anodized, but they only make them 406 to 430 or 450 to 470. Any models they made in between 430 to 450, discontinued, don't make them no more, can't get them. I'm having a tough time. I don't want to use a Cushcraft antenna because the thing is really, chintzy looking as far as construction of the thing. It's kind of cheap looking. I'd rather use something that has welded elements if I possibly can. Now, if I got a hold of a model that would say a 406 to 430, how much degradation would I get if I tried to use that up between 440 to 450? Would it fall off a lot or just a little bit?
Yeah, all of my experience with Yagi antennas, Joe, tells me you're in trouble. If I take a Yagi antenna, for instance, that's designed for 432, and I use it at 420, I'll get a slow fall off of performance. That same Yagi antenna designed for 432, 432 to 420, I've gone down 12 megs. If I go up 12 megs to 444, before. I might get a huge fall off in performance. Most Yagi antennas have a very steep cliff where they fall off fast as you go up in frequency, but a very slow slope as they fall off as you go down in frequency. The phenomena is because as you go up in frequency, eventually your directors, which were tuned high, are no longer high compared to your new frequency. They no longer become directors. They stop becoming reflectors as you go up, so you get a very rapid fall off. The vast majority of your gain of a well-tuned Yagi is the lensing effect of the slow wave structure of the array of directors that are out in front of that driven element. You want them to be tuned high to act as a capacitive slow wave structure to give you this double convex lens beam forming effect. And that dies fast as you move up and free. So that, with my previous experience, tells me you're not going to be very happy when you move significantly higher on an antenna. To buy one that's tuned high and use it down low, even though the frequency spread may be greater, the chances are you're going to be a little bit better off. Your only other choice is to take a known good design and simply scale everything proportional to wavelength. The good news about a Yagi antenna is that if you scale every single dimension proportional to wavelength, 99% of the time you're going to get the full performance on the new wavelength. Back to you, Joe, for any further comments. W2RYY, K2RYW.
All right, so it seems like from what you're saying, I'd be better off with a higher frequency antenna, and I have done this trick with at least one Yagi I've used in the past for a site-to-site type of, linking type of effect, where it was actually lower frequency, and I used higher frequency, and I used a couple of aluminum rods, actually hose clamp to the driven element and the bottom end of the driven element to actually increase the resonance at a lower frequency without doing anything to any other elements, and it seemed to make the tuning okay, but of course I can't measure the performance. So does it sound like it'd be better off with a higher frequency antenna just simply doing a trick like that, and whatever the director lengths and spacing happens to be, that's what I'm going to just end up living with, and I'll have a little less gain going from a higher antenna using a lower frequency than using an antenna that's designed lower frequency trying to use in a higher band?
The answer is yes, Joe. Start up with a higher antenna and move down to use it down to the lower frequency, even though the frequency spread may be a little bit greater. As I said, the fall off of gain versus frequency is a somewhat gentle slope as you move down. But as you move up in operating frequency compared to design, there's a very fast cliff at a particular frequency. I can't tell you at what frequency that cliff is going to occur. It's different for each Yagi design. There is no one Yagi design. Each Yagi designer has got different spacings, different dimensions, different element lengths, different tapers, and so on. They fall all over the lot. The one other piece of good news is that as you move down in frequency, you could, with a little bit of enthusiasm, retune the antenna to peak its gain at the lower frequency, doing nothing but adding little pieces of copper to the tips of the elements, making the elements electronically longer, even though physically you're not really lengthening them, by just putting little pieces of copper on the tips. You will therefore be adjusting the length electronically proportional to the longer wavelength of the lower frequency without changing the spacing. That's going to give you 95% of the performance. Element lengths are critical to a Yagi. Element positions, spacings between the elements, is nowhere near as critical. And if you're willing to properly tune the director string for the new lower frequency, you can force it to give you 98% of the same performance, even with the old element spacings. So with a little bit of backyard tweaking, you can make a 470 meg Yagi work beautifully at 450 megacycles, if that's what you desire to do by that procedure. Setting up the proper antenna range for doing that, take a look at February 1977 QST magazine. And by the way, if you're a QST, let me drop. If you're a member of QST, they just made a new policy by which a member has now full access to every single article per se that QST has ever published. So you can go back to the old articles. Therefore, you can look at February 1977, in which there was an article by RIW on how to set up a backyard ratiometry type antenna range by which you could with a little bit of care, get a 20th of a dB of gain difference accuracy by using that measurement procedure, even though you're in a reflective lawn area of your backyard. Back to you, Joe, for any fill on that. K2RAW.
Okay, the trick I use with one Yagi to simply get the resonant frequency lower to make it have a bit less reflective power is I didn't lengthen the up the driven element on the top side where the gamma match was going, and the bottom side. I actually simply put a piece of aluminum rod about half the length of those elements, but I used a couple of clamps, so miniature hose clamps, and actually just the mass of the metal was enough to get the resonant frequency to come down. So I actually didn't change the length, I changed the mass of the elements as far as the top and bottom compared to the bottom was concerned.
Be careful now though, Joe. When it comes to tuning a Yagi to the new frequency, the real tuning procedure is tuning the electronic length of the directors. Tuning the driven element only corrects standing wave ratio, does not change pattern, does not change gain. So don't be confused by the fact that the Viswar turned beautiful in the driven element, therefore you think the whole Yagi is working correctly. Viswar of a Yagi and gain bandwidth, frequency where the gain maximizes, thoroughly unrelated phenomena to the first order. Unrelated. In theory, if you had a double-stub tuner or the equivalent on the driven element, so that no matter what you do to tuning the directors, reflectors, and whatever, you can keep rematching the driven element and make the Viswar perfect, now you get the best of all worlds. Now there's never any mismatch of the driven element, because you just readjust the double-stub tuner accordingly, but you're tuning the directors for best gain. Now, when you move the length of an individual director, and you can do that, by the way, by having a piece of copper on the end of a long wooden stick, and you stand off to one side, and you hold the piece of copper near the tip of an element that adds length to the element. If the gain goes up at that time, you say, aha, that's the direction I want to go. If you hold the piece of copper near the center of an element, it's an H-field shunt, and it makes the element go higher in frequency, and you can tell if that's what it wants. So without changing the length of the element, just holding a chunk of copper on the end of a long, thin wooden stick, holding it near the center of an element or near the tips of the element, near the tips of the element, you're adding capacitance, and the element's going down in frequency. Hold it near the center of the element, the frequency is going up. So element at a time, you can find out which one's the most sensitive, what direction it wants to go, without moving the element itself. But in order for that to work well, you have to be able to resolve a whole series of very small gain steps. It's like a blind person walking up a hill. The hill may have a very gentle slope to it, but if you keep walking in the right direction, you'll eventually get to some altitude. By the same token, if you can carefully resolve, let me drop. If you can carefully resolve with accuracy, tenth or two-tenths of a dB of gain change, and you know when you're walking in the right direction, as you tune each individual element, you will rapidly get there. In 1 hour, maybe a half hour if you're skilled, you'll be amazed what gain increase you can get out of a Yagi on the brand new frequency using these tuning techniques. The nice thing about this ratiometry antenna range is that it is comparing your antenna on the test to a similar antenna side by side and looking at the gain difference between the two, and a good ratio meter, which nowadays are very inexpensive to build or buy, can easily resolve 0.05 dB of gain difference. And the reflectivity of the lawn in your backyard could be going up and down because the lawn is drying out. The transmitter could be going up and down in power output. The common mode rejection of a good ratiometer takes all of that back out. It only displays the difference in the gain between the two antennas. This technique is so powerful that it is now being used at arguably the world's best antenna range, the Romare Development Center in Utica, New York. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you for the information. I'm going to have to look that article up. I don't have to access direct access myself, but I guess somebody else can access it for me. February 1977, you said?
I'm pretty sure it's the February issue, 1977. If it's not, I know it's 77, or is it 76? 77 or 76, I should know. If I walk over to the plaque on the wall, I guess I'll find out. They gave me the front cover of the plaque. on that particular issue, I think. No. I don't have the darn thing displayed right now. I'll tell you what. In between these questions, I'll go and get that particular issue, which I've got in my bookcase, and I'll tell you the exact issue and the page number and whatever. You'll be getting that pretty soon. In the next 10 or 20 minutes or so, Joe. Okay, let's see. Who was the next person who signed in who gave us a yes? We definitely got a yes out of Paul, who's going to give us a space report. And let's see, I got a whole bunch of no's. Andy sounds like he's got a yes. Let's see what Andy's got to say. W-H-U-C-D-L. And we'll discuss anything except light-emitting diodes, and that's a joke, Andy. W-H-U-C-D-L if you're there, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Same topic, WS2N. I just wanted to make one comment on that.
Okay, we haven't left that subject yet. You got it, Paul.
Okay, nobody's tried that experiment with the mirror. I just tried it. That's pretty good, Dick. That's pretty good. I put the HT in front of me at eye level, and I took our inspection mirror that I used, and I did that experiment where you could see the antenna, you know, the rubber duct. And when you hold it out, like, down to the side, it's definitely horizontal, and it's still backwards. It's, you know, my antenna is on one side. It would appear on the left-hand, on the right-hand side, it still appears on the left-hand side, no matter if you hold it on your right hand or if you're on the left-hand. I mean, it's still backwards, but it's definitely horizontal. Good experiment, Dick. I never gave that a thought. I could see that signal coming back. Polarization would definitely be different, going from vertical to horizontal. Thank you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Yeah, you'd be amazed how few people have done that experiment of holding a mirror at a crazy angle like that and recognizing the fact that a vertical signal can become horizontal. A vertical human being can become a horizontal human being in the mirror reflection when you hold the mirror at a, what might call it, a 45-degree angle between horizontal and vertical, midway between below you and to the left of you, or midway between below you and to the right of you. It's called the depolarization effect. As you use a deep parabolic dish with a horizontally polarized feed on in front of the parabolic dish, the four diagonal corners of the dish give you this depolarization effect. The depolarization effect gets worse as the dish focal length to diameter ratio becomes a smaller number. So an F over D dish of 0.3 gives you a significant amount of depolarization effect in those four areas. A more shallow dish, a 0.6 F over D, like you've got with a 18-inch digital television type reception, a KU band dish, that's a much flatter dish, you get a hell of a lot less depolarization. Therefore, that's one of the mechanisms by which you get higher surface accuracy, surface efficiency, aperture efficiency. So there's a number of mechanisms that can give you aperture inefficiency. The depolarization effect is one of them. Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, wrote a nice article on that in Antennas and Propagation Journal, roughly 1972 or so. If you look up Turin, T-U-R-R-I-N, and Antennas and Propagation, you'll see his series of articles on the dual-mode feed horn as well as the depolarization effect. The guy who worked at Homedale Bell Laboratories at the time, who died prematurely by my standards. I really miss him. Okay. I think Andy had some further comments or questions. Let's see if Andy is there. W-A-2-C-D-L, the guy that keeps all these repeaters running nicely, along with Eric. K-2-R-A-W. You got it, Andy. Looks like Andy's not there. He signed in. He was going to give us lots of information, lots of questions, and he walked away. Whoa, Andy, how could you do that to us? Okay, let's see. Who else besides Paul is waiting in the wings? Let me turn it over to Mel. Hey, Mel, one of those guys at the Kings County Radio Club, those really progressive guys in Brooklyn, what have they been doing this week? Have you been keeping their research projects under control? K2KEY, K2RAW.
Okay, good evening all again. This is K2KEY. Well, we're going through a little bit of a problem. Floyd Bennett Airport, where we have our meeting, where you've attended, of course, our field day. That building is going to be closed down within approximately, I believe, a month. So we're going to have basically a, hopefully this is going to be